Did you ever feel like what you learned in law school didn't prepare you for the world of running a law practice? Law school didn't teach us how to start our practices the right way so that we could scale them into a thriving business. We didn't learn how to make sure that our businesses would meet our financial goals and provide the type of lifestyle we deserve. After 10 years, I was fed up with struggling in my practice and decided to begin a journey to scaling a successful practice that would actually allow me to finally live the life I've always dreamed of. I invite you to listen in on the conversations I'm having with some of the most successful solo and small firm practitioners, along with leading business entrepreneurs, and share how I am implementing what I am learning, all with the goal of helping you take control of your practice and your life. This is The Law Entrepreneur.
Hey there, fellow law entrepreneurs. Welcome to episode 255 of The Law Entrepreneur. I'm Neil Tyree, your host once again. And today, my guest once again is David Berkus. And David has been on the show in the past. And to say that he's one of my favorite authors is an understatement. He writes about business and management and entrepreneurial skills. And you're going to hear us discuss actually his latest three books. He's got one that's being released as we speak, but I'm a big fan of his writing, and I think there's a lot to learn there for solo and small firm practitioners here in the interview. What I really like about David's writing is how thoroughly researched it is, owing to the fact that he's has been a professor at the university level. His writing is meticulously researched and cited, and so there's scientific underpinnings to everything that he proposes in his books. So there's a lot to learn there for solo and small firm practitioners, and so let's not listen to me, let's listen to David Berkus. David Berkus, welcome back to The Law Entrepreneur.
Oh, thank you for having me. You know, back is the key word. I guess we didn't do terrible enough the first time, so I got the privilege of being back, so thanks for having me back as well.
Well, you may not remember, may not recognize this. You were on way back when in episode 119, and when we were talking about your book at the time, Friend of a Friend, and we'll talk a little more about that as we go forward. But I liked that episode so much and got so much positive feedback from it that we repeated the episode as episode 181. So if our listeners are go back that far and they say, hey, I think I heard that guy once or twice before, you're indeed correct. David was on twice before, even though it was just one appearance. So the
loyal fans have heard entirely too much of me already. All right.
No, I don't think so. I think we throw around the phrase favorite author, you know, a bit too casually, in my opinion. But I have to admit that as a fanboy here, you literally are one of my favorite authors. I don't know too many authors that I have multiple books from and that I hold each book in high regard. And not trying to gush too much, you know, we're going to be talking about what will be the third book that I have of yours that you recently are releasing. So to say that you occupy a significant position on my bookshelf is something of an understatement.
Oh, you are too kind. See, I was assuming that the only bookshelf where I had three copies of the book was my own, which, as you know, if you've seen photos of me behind my bookshelves, there are like 26 of each copies because we filled the whole shelf. I always thought that was to make up for, you know, the lack of multiples. But no, that's awesome. I thank you so much. I'm self-deprecating like that, but I truly do feel a sense of privilege in that regard, that really all, if you ask me what I do, I write books about topics that fascinate me. And I feel like the luckiest person in the world in that there's enough people to read those books that it allows me to keep doing it.
Well, you know, the only way to be successful as a writer, not that I have experienced it myself, but I think intellectually I understand this, is to write about something you like to write about. I mean, if you don't enjoy what you're writing about, it's work. It's slogging through the process and it's going to show. I think your joy in what you write about, at least as far as the three books that I've read, comes through, and it's really clear. Let me just recap that for our audience. So, Friend of a Friend, Understanding the Hidden Networks That Can Transform Your Life and Your Career. To me, and I've said this repeatedly on this program, that it is the best book on the science of networking that I've ever read. And I have a lot of friends who have written books about networking, some very close friends who have written books about networking, but it's the underlying science, and true to your, you know, background as a college professor, it is thoroughly annotated and footnoted to the research articles on which it is based. So if you really want to understand how the process of networking works from the science of it, you have to read Friend of a Friend.
Oh, thank you. No, that was the goal. In fact, one of our concerns was that we were going to be almost too scientific. The goal really was to teach a different approach to networking, one that was focused on the whole network and not just you and how to give an elevator pitch and how to keep in touch with people and that sort of thing. Because my theory is that people don't need that. What they need is to understand how the network that is the industry they're trying to make bigger gains in or whatever it is, how that network works. And then they can build a strategy that's unique to them, that takes into account their personality, et cetera. There's a ton of great networking books out there, but they were all usually written by one or two people. And so you try and implement it and you end up feeling like I'm pretending to be them and then I'm inauthentic.
100% true. I couldn't agree with you more. And there were some revelations in that book that we've gone over in the past, but things like working at the outer fringes of your network as opposed to the inner circles of the network, I thought was just mind-blowing. And if you had just said that, I think, you know, let's say we went to a bar association event and some guy got up there and say, hey, don't worry too much about the inner circle, the people that you interface with all the time. Mine the fringes of your network. That's where you're going to find the gold. I think if we had heard that, a lot of people would say, yeah, really? I don't think so. But the science and the research that you reference to support that observation, you know, makes it just jump off the page to me. It was just one of the more astounding things that I read.
Thank you. I mean, for those listening that haven't read it, a lot of the reason for that is just ideas, right? And information. The people that you are closest with, the people you've worked with for a really long time. I mean, I'm a big fan of close and long and in-depth business partnerships and things like that, you know, Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger-esque. Right. But those two are not discovering deals the other person knows about, right? In both cases in those two, it's the fringes of their respective networks that are bringing them new information, new ideas, new potential clients in the case of your listeners. That's going to come from the weak ties, the dormant ties, meaning people you haven't talk to in a while. There is an importance to having some bonded people you can rely on and trust, and what the research literature sometimes calls bonding capital, but it's the bridging capital. It's the stuff that introduces you to new markets or new potential clients. That's where the money is, and those are almost always at the fringes with people who, not strangers, so you don't have to hit the networking hour at the bar event, right? But with the people you already know but don't know that well, or the people that you know but haven't talked to in a long time, because it's easier to build rapport with those people, but they have just as much potential for new information as strangers.
Yeah, and for me, what I immediately did was go through my electronic Rolodex, my contact list, and I reached out to people that I knew that were friends of mine, but I hadn't spoke to, and relatives that I hadn't spoke to in a couple of years. And it was remarkable how responsive and what a valuable source of conversation and ultimately referrals that proved to be, just supporting the whole position as defined in your book.
Yeah. Oh, well, cool. It's so cool to hear that. Yeah. I will say there's no guarantees, right? I have no way of knowing exactly how many people you need to reach out with to get how many clients. If you're taking that approach, you probably got the wrong mindset to networking and building connections as whole. What I can guarantee is you will discover things you did not know, and that those things will lead to opportunities in a variety of different forms. And I love that you put that into practice, and it worked as well as I knew it would.
Yeah, and I repeated it to many people who've had, you know, similar, if not better, results in that regard. The other thing that really jumped out for me from that book, and I don't want to spend too much time on Friend of a Friend, although I encourage anybody, you know, you got to read this book. I'm telling you, it'll actually make your knowledge of networking as you've developed it over the course of other resources and products and books that much better and that much more understood. But the other part of the book that really opened my eyes a lot was the fact that there is research to support the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. And
you tell that story in a nutshell, because I think it's fascinating.
So the interesting thing is, when you dive into the research, you realize there's nothing special about Kevin Bacon, which I always feel bad about.
Right.
Because he's really, like, he started a charity called Six Degrees, which is meant to connect kind of B-list celebrities like him to maybe local charities that they can have a bigger impact being the spokesperson for, et cetera. So he's really done a great job with it, but he's a total fluke. The way it basically happened was a bunch of either hungover or inebriated college students were watching like daytime television, you know, back in the day when you could turn on like the Turner networks, TNT and TBS, and just see movie after movie after movie from a decade before. And they realized that several of the movies all had Kevin Bacon in them. So they began to theorize that that Kevin Bacon was in all this stuff, and started playing this little game. Could they connect different people through Kevin Bacon to explore how many movies? And eventually that, the way college students are, that worked into this grand theory of the universe where Kevin Bacon was the center of it, or at the very least the center of Hollywood. And this was before IMDb and those sort of tools where you could look all of this up. So you had to do it by memory, and thus began the game Six Degrees of Kevin Bacon, which lots of people have played. And now, thanks to databases, there's copious ways to play it, to check different websites like the Oracle of Bacon, which will tell you. I actually have been trying to sneak my way into a couple IMDb databases so that maybe I could get a Bacon number at some point. But the reality is, the researchers who have actually looked into it, there's nothing special. It's just a factor of network density. And in fact, the entire world is probably connected by 6 to maybe 7, if we're thinking about the most distant, hardest to reach countries, by 6 or 7 degrees of separation, because of what we often think of as those weak ties or dormant ties, because people move and they migrate. And you know, it just takes one person moving from one part of the country to another part of the country that creates a bridge for dozens of people. And over time, what you get is a network that's so resilient that everybody's interconnected with everybody. And as fascinating as I think that is, and as fascinating as it is to mathematically prove there's nothing. In fact, Kevin Bacon is like the 669th most connected person in Hollywood. It's not actually that high. As fascinating as all that is, I'm not actually all that interested in the six, right? Because 5 or 6 handshakes is a lot of handshakes to get to whatever VIP you're looking for. But I am interested in 1 or 2 degrees out, right? If the math is that 7.8, I think we're up to now, billion people and counting are connected by 6 degrees, then just how many people, millions, are connected by 1 or 2 degrees? And if you're exploring the fringes of your network, like we talked about before, you're much more likely to stumble into those. I go so far as to theorize those two things, right? The weak ties and the idea of this interconnectedness, or what in the research literature sometimes called the resilience of networks, between the people you know and haven't talked to in a while, the people that are your weak ties, and the people that they know, that's probably everyone you need to get connected to have whatever your definition of a thriving career or a thriving business is. You don't need to think about, how am I going to chase down 4 intermediaries to suddenly be talking to the head of the NFL or something like that. It doesn't matter. 1 or 2 degrees out will probably bring you everyone you need to get connected to.
Yeah, and I think it's a fascinating realization that you have that within your capability. You know, I don't want to be disparaging here, but there's a lot of pablum out there about, you know, if you can imagine it, you can realize it. If you can think it, it will be so. The fact of the matter is, if you want to identify somebody you want to reach out to, like, you know, for instance, on this podcast, I've had the opportunity to reach out to people that I never would have thought I could connect with. But it turns out that you just simply really have to ask. And you'll find that within, as you said, 1, 2, at most maybe 3 degrees, you're going to know somebody who knows somebody, a friend of a friend.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's why we called it the book. I will add one trick here. I know from experience and from the data that works better. So there was a couple studies conducted by social media companies like Facebook that actually showed, if you have a Facebook account, and there's only 2 out of the almost 8 billion people in the world that are, you know, active Facebook users, which is insane if you think about it, 2 billion. But if you have a Facebook account, Facebook showed that if it crawled through the whole network, if it used an algorithm to search for the most efficient paths, it was actually closer to between 4 and 5 degrees, right? And some of that is the smaller pie, but a lot of it is that algorithms can find the most effective connection and you can't. You can only talk to so many people so often. And so one of the things I've started advising people to do, and they've had great results with it, is to take an open posture on that very first step, right? So for example, in 2018, I switched a lot of the content that I create outside of writing from audio only to video. And I wanted to learn a lot more about film and television. I think that the little token narcissist in me kind of wanted to, you know, sign my own TV deal with a network. I don't think I'm that cool yet. Or, wow, I really did throw the yet in there. So that yet was the token narcissism.
There you go.
But I wanted to learn more about it. And so I could do a couple things, right? I could identify that target person, what I sometimes call LinkedIn stalking, right? Where you look up a specific company, you find this one person who's 3 degrees out, and then you go beg that one person that'll connect you to the other person, that'll connect you to the other person. And then maybe it works, often it doesn't. Or I could take an open posture. And so I started asking as often as possible, hey, who do you know that works in film and television? Who do you know that works in video production? Who do you know that I could just learn from? I'm just trying to learn more about this industry. And the number of names I got and the number of avenues. In fact, I even realized this was the funniest part about it. I realized that I actually already knew as a dormant tie, but hadn't talked to in a while, someone who I never knew about his first career, which was working on the Jim Henson production company.
Oh, wow.
For television shows for PBS, right? Like he started his career in film and television, then switched to marketing, right? And so he taught me a ton about how to create a 10-minute video that feels like a show and all that sort of thing. And I learned a ton from him, and I never would have found a weak tie even had I not just sort of put that out there and then had a mutual friend of ours be like, well, you know, you should talk to... So those sort of things happen all the time when you start that open posture. So I'm a big fan of that who do you know in blank question, asking that of a lot of different people, with blank being whatever it is, the city, the industry, whatever it is that you're trying to find connections in.
Right. Well, you know, as attorneys, you know, networking and building referral sources and identifying ourselves to referral markets or target markets is a fundamental aspect of what we do in terms of generating business. But another aspect of that, developing a solid law practice, involves community and the ability to be a source of inspiration or value or money to those in the community. And that leads us to the next book that you wrote that's a favorite of mine, called Pick a Fight, How Great Teams Find a Purpose Worth Rallying Around. And it's interesting because if you just think of the part of the book title that precedes the colon, Pick a Fight, like, okay, what does that have to do with building a law practice? And then if you look past the colon, How Great Teams Find a Purpose Worth Rallying Around, I think that tells you everything you need to know. And we hear a lot about law firms who take on a community responsibility, a social function within their neighborhoods, and how that endears them to the target audience that they're trying to reach for the services they provide. And so I think this is another fundamental book that solo and small firm practitioners absolutely deserve to embrace and to look within their own practices how they may pick a fight. So tell us a little bit about how that book came about and what the message involves.
Yeah, so this was a fun little project that we launched as audio only. Funny story about that, but we launched it as audio only in partnership with Audible. The idea being that most of our target market was reading with their ears, right? They were listening in the car on their commute in or on the subway and their headphones on the commute in, et cetera. And we launched it about 3 weeks before the world ended and everyone's commutes stopped. But that's a whole other monologue. And the idea behind it was thinking about friend of a friend and looking at some data that never really made the cut in friend of a friend, but then also thinking about the teams. You know, the whole second half of the book in friend of a friend is about organizational networks and how teams form and do you have enough diversity and how do you create teams that help people actually inspire people to get better, et cetera. And in looking at all of that, I started doing this litmus test with the clients that I would work with when it came to talking about purpose and mission and the reason we exist as an organization. Because every organization's got that, you know, everybody read an article or hired a $10,000 consultant to take you away for the weekend and come up with a mission statement, right? It's been like 30 years since we started talking about the importance of that in every organization. So everybody's got it.
Can I tell you just personally how
Yeah.
off-putting I find that whole
That's because, but see, the go ahead.
It may be, you know, a reason that I'm not as successful as I would like to be, because I haven't embraced the mission statement or the elevator pitch the way others have, but it just drives me nuts.
Well, I mean, I disagree with that. I think you've got it, at least for this show. You've never put it to words, but you are right to be skeptical, because we've known it for 3 decades. But what we've also known is that nobody reads the mission statement once it's written. Nobody internalizes it.
There's been the point.
Right. And so I started asking, where does that go wrong? And so what I learned is that I could kind of cut through the clutter when I was working with a team and figure out whether or not they actually had a unifying purpose or whether or not they even bothered to learn to regurgitate the mission statement. I started asking them, hey, if we think about the work that we're doing, what would you say we're fighting for? Right. And so that what are we fighting for question became really the guiding question to decide whether or not they had a sense of purpose. Not who are we fighting? That's a question about competitors, right? And there's a lot of leaders that go really the wrong way when they start talking about the war for talent. You remember that one? Or to fight for every percentage of market share. People, you know, I might go to work for a competitor one day. I don't want to use that language. I want to know, what injustice of the world are we seeking to alleviate? Or what's wrong with the industry that by doing business the way we do it, we're trying to transform, right? Or sometimes it's even just the fact that we see ourselves as the underdog and we're trying to kind of prove ourselves as worthy as being there. I mean, in your case, Neil, there is tremendous shifts in the world of law and in the world, especially if you're a smaller independent practice or a small practice owner and you're trying to get bigger. There's not a way that you do that anymore because of technology that doesn't require you to think of your practice like a business, right? You can't just hang a shingle on the door and say, I am a lawyer, come use my services for this anymore. It doesn't work like that. You can't just make sure you're in the phone book, et cetera, and let clients come into you. You've got to think of yourself as a business if you want to exist. So, you know, in your case, you've never said it, but I would categorize you as in that ally fight because you see what your listeners are fighting for, which is their very existence. And you realize that the key to helping them win that fight is thinking about their practice as a business. So the funny thing about that is if you do that, you don't even have to have a mission statement, or you don't have to change the mission statement from what the current organization is. But I think every team is much more bonded, and the research supports this in a variety of ways, is much more bonded and motivated if they've got that unifying sense of purpose. I use that fight rhetoric for it. Some of that is hyperbole for sure, right? A lot of it probably comes from the fact that I've got almost 2 decades of martial arts training in me, right? So I just sort of gravitate. So I get that that doesn't go for everyone. So you could, you know, use cause, et cetera. But the idea is that there is something bigger than our organization that we are working to do, or a change that is bigger than our organization that we're working to make. And by doing the day-to-day, we become a part of that movement.
Today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur is brought to you by my friends at Spotlight Branding. For many years, marketing companies have focused on funnels that run for a short time, often leaving dozens of leads behind that didn't make a decision yet. Spotlight Branding has found a better way. It's called a content loop, and it's changing the way attorneys think about their marketing. This system nurtures your leads in perpetuity with quality, evergreen content that elevates your credibility and helps the rest of your marketing actually work. If you're interested in learning more, head over to spotlightbranding.com/TLE, as in The Law Entrepreneur, to learn more about the content loop and how it can revolutionize your law firm's marketing. Spotlight Branding, more referrals, better clients, higher return on investment. Now, if you've been a listener of this podcast for any time, you know that I sing the praises of Ruby all the time because they're really responsible in my own practice for helping me grow my business, deliver personalized experience to my clients, you know, building customer loyalty, really, in terms of having a consistent front-facing office partner in Ruby, and allows me to stay connected anywhere, anytime to my business through their services. So I can't say enough about Ruby. I'm delighted to have them and continue to have them as a sponsor of this podcast. And this episode of The Law Entrepreneur is sponsored by Daylight, the all-in-one contact relationship manager, or CRM. I've been using Daylight for well over 10 years now, and it's the best CRM for business on the Mac and iPhone.
And despite having a case management platform that I'm very happy with, I still use Daylight to handle all of my many other law firm needs. When you're running your own law firm, it can be difficult to stay on top of follow-ups, keep track of details and communication, and stay aware of what needs to be done next on each project. Daylight organizes everything in one place, so you don't have to rely on your memory to keep it all straight. If you're feeling like it's time to upgrade from spreadsheets to a CRM, check out Daylight. You can download it from the App Store or visit www.marketcircle.com and try it free for 30 days. On top of that, you can get your first month free when you tell them you heard about Daylight here on The Law Entrepreneur. Daylight by Market Circle, staying top of mind without the stress.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the martial arts aspect as well, because as lots of folks know, I'm a retired practicing martial artist and spent, you know, just about the same amount of time, 25 years as you did practicing. And it's interesting because in the martial arts, you know, we teach this philosophy that you're not just, it's not combat for the sake of combat, but it serves a higher purpose. It reveals more about you than it does about your opponent, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that unifying principle is what really stood out to me in the audiobook, because I could hear in my own brain how attorneys can look to this as an opportunity to define what is it that we're really trying to do. We're not just trying to beat the other guy. We're trying to represent our clients.
Right.
And to improve their lives. And to the degree that we can narrow that down to a specific area, whether you want to improve the lives of the people who have been in an abusive relationship, or you want to improve the lives of people who have suffered from financial hardship, or you want to improve the lives of people who have been wrongly accused, you know, that's the fight that's worth fighting for.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
It moves you from that bland purpose to something that's tangible and gives you a reason to do what you do.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, one of the interesting things is, so the Gallup organization has had their famous Q12 survey of employee engagement. A lot of people listening may have either heard about it or maybe even conducted it in your firm, depending on the size. And even though it's proprietary, the questions are available for everybody. And one of the questions is, does the mission and vision of the company make me feel my job is important? And it's the combination that is what we want, right? It's not just enough to have it. It's, can we see in our day-to-day work how that happens? And that's why I think it elevates from just a bland generic purpose to a fight. What is the better future that we are working towards, usually by removing an injustice or something like that? What is the better future for that we're working towards, or that our clients are working towards, that we can help? And then your job as a leader, once you've established that, it gets a whole lot easier, because at that point you just become chief storyteller, right? It just becomes your job to remind people of the stories, to remind people of the story of the client that you just finished up with that was in an abusive relationship and now has somebody defending her and her children, right? Or the client who's, this actually literally just happened to us. We have some close friends of ours whose father passed away, you know, elderly father passed away, didn't leave a will, didn't even leave passwords for his computer, right? And if ever there was a way to get connected to the fact that we've got that stuff settled, right? That family didn't, but we've got it. There's even just that sense of relief as you're trying to help them move through that. And that's a fight, right? So those sort of things, your job as the leader becomes the chief storyteller, reminding people of those incidents where you swooped in there and were actually able to help people win that fight, or that you are making progress in that larger fight of transforming an industry, can have a massive, massive motivating effect.
Yeah, I think that your point to the degree to which you can convey and really bring your staff, your support, to adopt and feel and internalize that same mission, as it creates, you know, the momentum for a really productive, a really happy workforce, one that feels like they're not just going, you know, to the office to do a job, but they're engaged in, quote, the battle as well, and it gives value to them, and therefore it's going to bring value to your firm.
Yeah, totally. And I will say, smaller firms have an easier chance of doing this. Sure. Usually if they're you and maybe support staff, but you're the only actual, you know, attorney, it's a lot easier for people to catch that mission and vision. Where this becomes really, really crucial of getting it solidified and understanding the role of sharing those stories and passing those along is as soon as your organization grows to the point where not everyone is in touch with you every single day, maybe because there's a mid-level of management, maybe because they're scattered about, you don't talk to them all the time. As soon as everybody's not interacting with you every single day, you can't rely on your own personal sense of mission to spill over onto them anymore. So it needs to be codified, it needs to be defined, and then it needs to be reinforced through new updates, new stories that help solidify why we're in that fight or how much progress we're making.
Now, is there a way to kind of categorize or define the types of challenges that would qualify as a fight, or is it kind of a wide open spectrum? It could be anything.
Yeah. So in a sense, it could be anything. I called it the three fights in the audiobook, but I look at those as sort of templates or almost Mad Libs, right? Mm-hmm. They're a way to phrase what your purpose is. And then there's some underlying research behind why those templates are written that way. And so I call those the revolutionary fight, the underdog fight, and the ally fight. And the revolutionary fight is about the industry or about society. It basically just says, you know, the industry says this is acceptable and we refuse to accept that. So when you can say the industry says that doing this things this way is acceptable and we refuse to accept that, that can be anything about what you're trying to change about the law industry, or it could be about in the area of law that you practice, things that you do your best work when you have a certain client, because those clients are helping to change the industry, right?
Or how you deliver your services.
Or how you deliver your services. Exactly. So that's the revolutionary fight. So by doing things the way we do them, right, we're changing the, or we're seeking to change the industry or correct something in the industry. Anytime you can say this is the norm and we find that norm unacceptable, you're starting a revolution. A small one, you know, like lowercase r, but still a revolution. Then there's the underdog fight, which is not just about being small. It's actually about being what I would say underrated, right? Because we know there's a massive motivating effect when people feel like they've been on the unjust end of criticism, when they've been underrated or underconsidered. They work harder to prove to themselves, but also to the very critics that, for lack of a better term, hated on them, are working to prove those people wrong. And so that's less about what our day-to-day is and more about who we're going to prove wrong or who we're going to prove deserve to be there, right? So that's the underdog fight. And then the ally fight is actually the easiest and also the hardest, because it says it's not about our fight at all. It's about their fight. And you get to define who they is. In the case of law, most of the time, it's going to be your clients, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not about our fight. It's about their fight. It's about what they're fighting for. And here's how we help them and have that very clearly laid out.
Yeah, I just think it's fascinating, it's spot on, and it's so translatable to the practice of law. It just leaps out at me. And that really then takes us to the final step here, the most recent step in the journey of reading all things that are Dick's. And that's your most recent book, which is either coming out the week that we're recording this, or by the time our listeners hear it, it will definitely be out. But the book is called Leading from Anywhere, The Essential Guide to Managing Remote Teams. And given where we are in today's world, given the fact that we're, you know, shut in and likely to be so, sadly, for, you know, a while longer, I mean, it's a very topical and pertinent book. There's a lot of folks writing on this subject, but I think of all of those who have this understanding, moving from, you know, building a network to finding a cause to being able to manage that team and lead from anywhere, I can think of, you know, very few people who could write on that topic the way you have. Tell us a little bit about how this book came about and what the mission is.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. So as I said, I released the Pick a Fight as an audiobook. I joked just before the world ended, but we launched it in February 25th, I think, of 2020. No idea that this was going to be, even some idea that this was going to be interesting, but, you know, looking at it like, okay, maybe this is going to be like MERS or SARS-CoV-2. There's going to be, right. I see a lot of people wearing masks on airplanes, but that'll be the extent of it, right? And then by March, let's say 15th in most of the world, some places a couple days sooner, the whole, like, we shut it all down, right? And it sort of blindsided everybody. And I look at my primary goal, I say now, is that I'm trying to help teams do their best work ever. And at in the early part of 2020 and in 2019, when I wrote Pick a Fight, purpose, mission, et cetera, getting clear language about that was one of the most important pressing needs. But it became obvious by March, that isn't what people need. I mean, some people need it, but what people need right now is, how do we do this thing? We've been relying on proximity. We've been relying on the fact that we were in the same space with each other to smooth over a whole bunch of inefficiencies in how our team actually works. That combined with an interesting email from my publisher talking about, you know, we want to put together something on this. Would you be interested? A lot of the companies that are fully distributed, I profiled in a book I wrote actually prior to Friend of Friend called Under New Management, looked at all of that and basically said, yeah, here's the gap I saw in the marketplace. There was a lot of people writing some great stuff, books, articles, video series, podcasts, et cetera, on work from home productivity. Right. And then there was a lot of people writing about what I would say the macro trend of remote, right? Meaning here's what it is to have a whole company that's fully distributed. Books like Remote from Jason Fried and David Hanemeyer Hansen, which are great books. But I was thinking about, I lead a team of eight, right? And either because we're a small business, or I lead a team of eight because I'm a mid-level manager at Frito-Lay, right? What do you got? And there was nothing. There was nothing saying, okay, let's just focus on your team, not the whole thing, but let's just focus on getting your team collaborating when they're not together. And that became Leading From Anywhere. I think the trend we're at, you know, we're recording this January 2021. I'm an optimist. I have to assume that by the end of 2021, which, by the way, can we just say is amazing? By the end of 2021, everyone who wants a vaccine will have a vaccine. We'll start to get back to whatever normal, new abnormal, if you will, and people will be located near each other again, working together. But you don't send 70 million people to work from home for a year and then expect them all to want to come back to 9 to 5, Monday through Friday.
Right.
So the future we're headed for is what I often call the work from anywhere future. It's not about work from the office or work from home. It's about the flexibility of all of it. And thus became sort of Leading From Anywhere, which is what I hope is sort of that manual for, you're leading a team where you can't rely on everyone to be there every single day. Well, what are the lessons from fully distributed companies we can apply for people looking to lead that team, get them collaborating and communicating in a way that doesn't require their physical presence? Physical presence is a great bonus, but doesn't necessarily require it. And that became Leading From Anywhere. We structured it around basically the whole life cycle of a team, from how do you start, whether it's a company or start a new team or new venture, how do you hire people, all of those sort of things, even into how do you say goodbye when it's time to say goodbye, and kind of everything in between. Most of the problems you'll face either have a dedicated chapter or have a little blurb in the frequently asked questions section at the end, just to try and tell people, based on research, based on best practices, this is what you need to know. It's less a manifesto for the world of remote work, like a lot of the prior to 2020 books are, and more of a survival guide to the world that we're living in now.
There's two things that I think are really key to the book. One, as with all of your work, it's phenomenally well researched, and so you know, it's more than just a knucklehead like me saying, I think these are my observations. I think this is what the future holds. You, again, once again, have provided all, you know, the necessary footnotes and citations, so that we have some confidence in knowing that, you know, this is based on data, not based on suppositions, not based on, you know, your feelings. It's based on the data and the observations that you've made working with companies that you've worked with on your previous books. And so that's really kind of refreshing for me. And then the second part of that is, I love the model that you chose in terms of tracking the life cycle of a team from inception to hiring them onto the team, all through the process to the point of, you know, when you finally have to say goodbye, as you said. So there are all different aspects of how to engage the team and manage them and help them find that balance that they need between their work and their life, so that they can be productive and feel good about the work they're doing for you.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. Yeah. I mean, some of that too was geared around the idea that everyone's going to be in a different phase of this. Depending on how flexible you were as an organization before the pandemic, you might have an easier time. You know, if you already had people that had work from home days or things like that. Also, depending on what state you're in or what country you're in, your experience of the great work from home experiment has been different. So the idea was essentially introduce a couple core concepts and then turn to the page which represents the dilemma you're currently facing, right? Right. And that might be hiring. That might be we still haven't figured out communication. That might be how do we do performance management because we've been doing this 6 months and our people deserve some feedback. Whatever problem you're facing now, right? Turn to that chapter. And so it seemed like just the most logical way to structure it. It's not sort of a choose your own adventure book, but it's almost like choose your own dilemma book.
Well, exactly. So, I mean, it sounds like perfectly logical for you to structure it that way, but I haven't seen any other book, any other work structured from that perspective. So I think, you're ahead of the game there. And it's interesting, as I've spoken with lots of coaches and successful attorneys who are transitioning to this remote work environment. I was kind of stunned when I heard that one of the primary concerns that the managing partner or the owner of the law firm had was making sure that their employees were actually productive and doing the work they said they were doing or properly spending the hours they claim to be spending. And it struck me that if you have that kind of unsure belief of what your employees are doing, because you can't see them, you can't walk down the hallway and observe that they're working as they say they're supposed to be working, you got a bigger problem than just mechanics of remote engagement.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the big dilemmas in April and May, right, when it became obvious that 15 days to slow the spread might possibly be 365 or more.
More, right.
Was what I, one of the, I saw articles all over the place. What spying software or monitoring? Right. That's the fancy term, right. Spying. Should right. I buy, et cetera? And the mentality is like, if that is the question you're trying to answer right now, you screwed up four steps back, right? Like, let's go back. Let's work our way backwards. And let's talk about, you're obviously not hiring for trust, or you're obviously not delegating decisions and delegating projects enough to trust. You are obviously relying on the dangerous proxy that presence equals productivity. And now you have no idea what to do when that proxy is removed for you, right? And there's a bunch of different solutions for that, but none of them are software, right? All of them are usually conversation, right? Or some system. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the challenges of motivation, because I do think at this point, as we are staring down, several more months of the same or largely the same, I do get a sense out there in the community that there's a certain degree of fatigue involved here, and that people are searching for ways to motivate their team in a remote environment. Talk a little bit about what you observed and advocate in that area.
Yeah, so I'd say there's a couple different things here. The first would be, let's say, burnout, right? Yeah. Which I think is a different issue to try and solve than just motivation. There's certain things you can do that you can demonstrate or you can encourage of your people that'll help with burnout. Things like setting business hours, and that doesn't mean 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, but that does mean encouraging everyone on your team to keep a calendar. This is when I'm working and this is when I'm not working. And in fact, this can be a huge plus, right? There's a lot of people struggling with the idea that I'm supposed to help Zoom school my kids while also get work done, et cetera. And a lot of that is the mentality that, we're doing these things overlappingly. As a leader of a team, you can say it's okay if from 9 a.m. to noon, you actually have to be focused on that. In fact, the whole idea that we care here about hours work versus outcomes is a whole other paradigm shift beyond just the presence equals productivity thing. But even the if we're going to talk about hours, let's talk about what hours you're most effective and which ones you're not because of other things that are going on. If you're lucky enough to be able to draw distinct physical boundaries between where you do work and where you do life, that's hugely important. If you can't, then at least draw digital ones. So for example, the single biggest burnout tactic I have for most people is if you can afford it, get a second device, not a second phone, but like I have a phone and I have a tablet. One is a work device and it gets switched out at the end of the day for a tablet that basically has no way you can get a hold of me and tell me about that new thing you need me to work on. It's just there for like, so that I can watch Netflix and check in on my personal Facebook or that sort of thing, right? Or read from my Kindle, that's it. So little things like that can be huge on the burnout side. on the motivation side, we sort of have, you know, I remember in Good to Great with Jim Collins, he talks about the Stockdale paradox of sort of always thinking it's about to be over and then being crushed when it isn't, right? Yeah. We sort of had that happen to us. And that's a problem, right? At this point, we should not be using language like that, you know, when such and such happens, we're all coming back. We're not, because not everyone's going to want to. Some people rebuilt their entire calendar from scratch and have a far more integrated life that relies on not being at the office from 9 to 5. And they're not going to want to come back to that. The other thing that I think happens is when we're seeing each other every day and we can use some socialization as a way to keep people engaged, we push deadlines out, right? I mean, most companies, most large organizations only ever do reviews, feedback sessions once a year, which is insane. But they will stress the importance of quarterly or monthly check-ins. The teams that work the best in a remote environment, they shrink their deadlines down to 1 week or 2 weeks, right? Some of them stole from software development, from Scrum, from Agile, and do daily check-ins on here's what I worked on yesterday, here's what I'm working on today, here's where I need help. And the fact that you're thinking about objectives from day to day will actually make it easier to track progress and make it easier to have those little small wins that keep people motivated. What I think is really demotivating right now, beyond the fact that we're forced into working in isolation, is that we're working toward projects that are many, many months out. And law, by the way, you know, law moves slowly. So this is even more important in this regard, because it normally moves fairly slowly anyway. So we need to be thinking about what are those intermediary signposts we can put up that are our way to demonstrate progress to the team so that we can keep them motivated and engaged. Progress is one of the most potent human motivators, especially when you feel like you're working alone. To just know you're making progress and checking in with the team much more often so that you're working alone together, those two little interventions will be huge.
Yeah, and put that in kind of concrete terms, you know, observation I've had with respect to working with clients. You know, when clients came into the office, they didn't want to come in too frequently because they recognized that, you know the billable hour clock was running while they were there. And it also was, you know, kind of cumbersome to come into the office. And so you spread those kinds of interactions out over the course of the time during your representation of that client. Now that we've gone more remote, you can't not reach out to your contact for weeks on end and say, okay, here's what I did in the last month. You have to engage with them on a more regular basis. And those little incremental steps, as you say, do show momentum. They do show engagement. They do create positive feelings with the concept of the matter moving forward. And I think that's going to be the norm going forward. I don't think we're going to go back to the, hey, you'll hear from your attorney once a month.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. So yeah. So right on the staff side and on the client side, yep. that kind of more frequent, they're going to be less in-depth conversations. For sure. Right? If you're rolling your eyes and going, I can't possibly do that every week. They're check-ins, they're little quick conversations, but happening much more frequently is huge.
Email. Right. A one or two sentence email, I think, is sufficient.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed.
So, well, listen, David, you and I mean, I personally could spend the rest of the afternoon here with you. I want to direct our listeners' attention to your website, davidburkus.com. Pretty much all things David Burkus you can find there, including your TEDx talk, which is really great. You know, I was saying earlier, I think I was speaking with John Corcoran, who yeah. I think is responsible for introducing me to you. He introduced me to when you did your live summit. That's where I think I first connected with you. But anyway, be that as it may, you know, I think there's an awful lot to gain from visiting this website. Is there any other way that our audience should reach out to you if they want to follow up or anything you had to share with us today?
Yeah, no, I mean, so davidburkus.com is probably the best place. If you're like, I can't possibly remember that. I know it's a weird last name. It's harder to remember. But if you're a longtime listener of this, you've heard me too much, just check out the show notes. There'll be links yep. to all everything there. So, and Neil wants you to check them out anyway, because he puts a lot of care into preparing them. He just doesn't want to tell you every episode. So I'm going to tell you this episode. Check that area out as well, or davidburkus.com. Either one to keep the conversation going. And I hope you do, because we're not all going back to the office tomorrow. So this is a conversation we're going to be having for a long time.
And I will tell you also that on the website, there's a ton of resources that you can tap into. And if you download the audiobook, Pick a Fight as an example, or any of the other books in audio format or a hard copy if you have that. Each chapter has a link to specific resources to find out more information about that topical area. I mean, you can just take a really deep dive into all this data and all this information. And I think it's a resource that attorneys really deserve to treat themselves to. So I'm very happy to share that with our audience. And I hope that you'll come back and join us again after the next book.
Yeah, no, happy to. Thank you again so much for having me.
All right, David. Thanks again for being a guest on The Law Entrepreneur.
Well, there you have it, Law Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us today and with this episode of The Law Entrepreneur. I want to thank our sponsors, as usual, Ruby Receptionists, Daylight, and Spotlight Branding. Make sure you swing on by our website at thelawentrepreneur.com or visit our Facebook page or Twitter account. You can find us anywhere by just searching on The Law Entrepreneur. Also, if you'd be kind enough, I'd love it if you could go to your podcast application and leave us a rating and a review. It helps with our visibility and it helps ensure that we're there to be found when people come looking for podcasts in the legal space. So once again, thanks for being a part of today's episode of The Law Entrepreneur.